Welcome back to the Groundless Ground podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Dale Miller. This is the first in a series of dialogues on the clinical use of embodied contemplative practices. My guest is Peter Payne. Peter is a researcher at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College, a master Qigong teacher, and a longtime somatic experiencing practitioner. His collaboration with Marty Crane Goudreau, assistant professor of microbiology and immunology at the Geisel School of Medicine, continues to generate important studies on the use of Qigong and targeted mind-body practices for mitigating the deleterious effects of physical disease processes and mental health disorders. Peter's deep interest in embodied and affective neuroscience has made him a pivotal contributor to the theoretical modeling of interoceptive, kinesthetic, and proprioceptive mechanisms of somatic experiencing. I can't think of a better person to kick off this series of dialogues on the value and use of embodied contemplative practices. Thank you for being here, Peter.
Thank you very much, Lisa, and I'm really honored to have this invitation. I'm very excited about this podcast. I wanted to mention one thing. You mentioned that I was at the Geisel School of Medicine, and what most people don't realize is that Dr. Geisel is Dr. Seuss. He was the one behind the Cat in the Hat and all those wonderful books. So the medical school is named after him.
That is so cool. I had no idea.
The principal research project that I'm working on at the moment is investigating the biological and psychological effects of a particular form of Qigong. We're actually working with flight attendants for various reasons that I don't need to go into. But these flight attendants have all been exposed to secondhand smoke in the course of their flying back before the ban. And so they're suffering various kinds of pulmonary and autonomic dysfunction. So what we do is we take a group of these women and measure a variety of biomarkers, questionnaires, blood draw, and so forth, teach them Qigong for 3 or 4 months, and then remeasure. So in phase one, where we taught in person, we got a bunch of very good results, reduced blood pressure, reduced levels of systemic inflammation, improvement in the 6-minute walk test, which is a kind of measure of physical function and endurance. Then in the second phase, we wanted to see whether we could teach this stuff via video, because, you know, teaching in person is very limited, and given that there are not very many people who teach what I teach. So we made a series of videos to teach this, and then did the same experiment, this time only remote teaching via video, and found much the same kind of results. So that was a very nice confirmation of something that I already knew, but it's nice to have the actual science. So we've actually got 2 papers already published and 1 paper in review at the moment about these experiments. In the process of this study, we started out with the idea, okay, we're going to teach these people some Qigong exercises, and they're going to practice regularly for 30 minutes a day, and they will see the results.
Let's give people some context. I think the smoking ban was instituted maybe in the early 1990s. I remember being on international flights going back and forth from Tokyo to New York, and people were still smoking on flights then. So the flight attendants you're working with now must be in their 60s and 70s, and of course primarily female. That means you're teaching women a body-mind practice at a point in their lives when they may never have done anything like Qigong.
You know, that's exactly right, Lisa, and it was a real sort of accidental plus in terms of the study. I mean, the youngest participant, I think, was 57. And the oldest was, I think, 78. So we're dealing with an older group of women. And one of the fascinating things is that, of course, normally what you would expect is that at this age, the various markers of health will gradually start going downhill, if not rapidly in some cases. Now, in the second study, we did a controlled study. So that meant we were matching the group that we taught Qigong with a matched group who did not receive any instruction, but instead watched TED Talks. So in other words, it was an attention control, so as to control for the idea of just the fact that they were receiving attention and they were doing something. And what we found really, really consistently, the graphs are wonderful, that you see in most of the measures, intervention group, there's a substantial improvement in health. And in the control group, there's a reduction in health, or sometimes no change. Everybody who participated in the control group was then given the opportunity afterwards to receive the same training as the intervention group. So that was actually a further source of data. And also, as you say, we didn't want to leave people disappointed.
It might be good to pause and acknowledge that there are probably a number of listeners who've never heard of Qigong and have no idea where it came from or what it is.
The word Qigong itself is actually of very recent origin. It was coined in the 1940s by a communist cadre who chanced upon an amazing teacher in the Chinese village where they were learned Qigong and said, wow, this is amazing, what do you call it? There wasn't really a word for it because this kind of teaching was so prevalent in China traditionally that there wasn't really a specific word for it. So they coined the word Qigong to refer to this whole extremely broad field. What Qigong means is, Qi means breath or life energy, and Gong means work. So Qigong means working on your life energy or working on your breath. So breath and life energy, you know, in pretty much all languages of the world are deeply connected. The description that is most commonly used in Chinese traditions is balancing the body, balancing the breath, balancing the mind. It works equally with the physical body, the breath and other energy flows in the body, and what one could call the mental state or attention and awareness. So it's very much of, you know, what you could call a holistic kind of approach. It doesn't, and this is a really important point, Qigong and other similar arts that I'm interested in, they don't start with the division between mind and body that's so common in the West, you know, Cartesian divide. It's not that they say, oh, mind and body are related or mind and body affect each other. They say mind and body are not two separate things. They're just different facets of a single whole being. So that's a very different attitude, and it's actually kind of hard for Westerners to really get their minds around that. It's a very, very different perspective. Qigong works on balancing the body, balancing the breath, balancing the mind. It uses physical posture and movement to work on the body. It uses particular breathing practices and also internal imagery to work on the flow of energy through the body. And it uses what one could describe as meditative practices to work on the mind. But all these three, with most Qigong practices, all those three are happening at the same time. You're not separately doing physical and breath and mind. It's a single practice.
I imagine some people may be listening to this and thinking about yoga.
They're in the same general ballpark. They're both considered forms of meditative movement, and they have a lot of similarities, but they also have huge differences. And I think that a lot of people are not aware of that. The basic philosophy behind yoga is, of course, Hindu philosophy. Basic philosophy behind Qigong is Taoist philosophy, traditional Chinese philosophy. And there is a vast difference. I mean, from a Western point of view, you might say, well, they're both Asian, you know, but they're as different from each other as they are from the standard Western point of view. One very obvious difference is that Qigong involves a great many practices which are standing and moving in various complex ways. Also, Qigong involves interactive dual practices, training you how to handle difficult relationships by moving with somebody else. And again, that's not something that you find in yoga. Observe a Qigong class and a yoga class, you're going to see something very, very different, even though there are certain fundamental things that they share in common.
I love Taoist philosophy, but would it be correct to assume that the Qigong interventions you gave the flight attendants did not include instruction in Taoist philosophy? Am I wrong about that?
Yes, you're wrong.
I love this.
It was actually pretty interesting because, as I said before, we started off with this idea that we'd teach them certain movements and they'd practice them half an hour a day. The reaction we got was, okay, we love all this, but there's no way that we have time to practice half an hour a day. We're going to have to drop out of the study. So what we did at that point is we shifted into teaching the distilled fundamental essence of Qigong that did not have to be practiced, that could just be integrated into their daily life. I mean, I've studied a huge variety of different body-mind practices, you know, all my life, starting with judo when I was 11 and didn't stop since then. And since very often during that period, really good information, really good teachers were just not available. So I had to kind of glean and figure out. I continually tried to distill the Qigong down to its essence, okay? And what I came to realize is that its essence could be expressed in just standing, just a simple standing posture, done in a certain specific way, but nothing elaborate or strange, nothing that would draw attention if you did it in the street. The same is true for sitting, the same is true for walking, and for moving around doing things. So all of those everyday actions can be done, if you like, in a Qigong way, which really means in a natural way.
Which really means in a non-dual or non-meditation of meditation way.
That's exactly right. It really is. And as you know, conveying that non-dual meditation state, it's, you know, words fail me a little bit. It's really tricky to convey that state. But one could also say it's really easy and simple if it's correctly conveyed. But it does involve a kind of understanding, not a conceptual understanding, a sense of what one is getting at, which is, you know, basically a non-dual, or in the Taoist context, the way that they tend to say it is Wu Wei. It's spelt W-U-W-E-I, which is translated as not doing. But it doesn't mean passivity. It means allowing things to be natural. And it's basically the same concept as is expressed in the highest reaches of Tibetan Buddhism, like in Dzogchen, allowing the mind to be in its natural state.
How about if we give listeners direct experience of Qigong? Maybe you can give a standing Qigong exercise. And for those of you listening while driving, I'll offer a presencing practice my patients affectionately call just driving.
Stand up and put your feet a comfortable distance apart. So that's, you know, maybe roughly hip distance apart, not too wide, not too narrow. What I'll take you through, first of all, is a kind of brief checklist in terms of the balance of the various parts of the body so that you end up in a position which is as effortless as possible. So you start off by paying attention to where your weight is on your feet. And you can rock your weight back and forth a little bit so that it's more on the heels and then more on the toes, and then find the middle. So it feels like the whole foot is, it's almost as if it's like a suction cup adhering to the ground. There's no tension, but there's a kind of resilience. You're right in the middle of your whole foot. Then you pay attention to your knees and just kind of wiggle your knees a bit. So we want knees not locked back, and not bent. Then bring your attention up to your pelvis and to your tail. And you can start by like arching your back a little bit, arching your tail as if you were lifting your tail up behind, and then drop it. And then tuck your tail under, and then drop it. That's great. So the tail is not arched, not tucked. Now for the shoulder girdle, you hold your arms very slightly in front of your body and out to the side a little bit. And now turn your palms so that they face forwards and then up. So you rotate the whole, that's right. Feel your forearms turn as you continue, feel your upper arms rotating. And then you almost feel your shoulder girdle rotating backwards a little bit. Now leave your shoulder girdle like that and turn your palms to face backwards so that you feel like a gorilla. So now you have wide in front and wide in back. And then just let the arms gently sink down by your sides, but stay with that feeling of breadth through your shoulders. Now you're going to place your finger on your upper lip, and you're going to push the head back slightly so that it comes more over the middle of your body. Let go with your finger. Don't try to hold your head in position. Let it just be very lightly balanced. And finally, tap with your finger on the very top of your head. Tap, tap, and then snap your finger above your head. Drop the arm down and feel like your whole body is suspended from above, not pulled up. This is important, but hanging down from above, suspended like a puppet. So this gives you correct alignment through your body. Now feel that everything heavy or dense in your body flows away down through your body, down through your legs, and away into the ground. So all heaviness, tension, and obstruction flows deep down into the ground and forms like a kind of anchor or root into the ground. As you do this, you feel like the rest of your body becomes light. Since you've dropped the weight away, you feel relieved of the weight and you feel light and open. Now, as you feel that sense of rooting deep into the ground and becoming light and open, feel that now you can let yourself expand out into the space around you. Let your awareness be open to the space and the things or people in the room around you. So this brings you towards a state which my own name for this is the natural state. There's a natural state of the body effortlessly balanced. There's a natural flow of the breath, and the mind or the awareness is naturally open to the space all around you. So, you know, in terms of what we taught the flight attendants and in terms of what I've just taught you, any time that you're standing anywhere, you can remind yourself of that. You could run through the little checklist, but the most important part of it is that sense of release the weight down into the earth so that you become light, so that you can open up to the space around you.
That was so beautiful.
Before we launch into a discussion of embodied neuroscience, I'd love to give just a short exercise for those of you who are driving. As you know, when you're driving, it's very important to have your attention on driving, being where you are when you're driving. Where you are is in a car. The car is moving. Allow your awareness to open to the experience of your still body in the car that's moving. The body is moving, and yet the body is still. Allow your awareness to land in your visual field to really see. Now, you probably thought, oh, I was seeing before. But if you draw your awareness into your eyes and you literally see through your eyes, you'll see more of what there is. And when we're driving, it's always better to see more rather than less. Another way to land in the experience of driving is to feel your hands on the steering wheel. Feel the temperature of the steering wheel, whether your hands are holding the wheel tightly or loosely. And include that along with seeing. And include seeing and feeling along with the experience of moving in the car. And hopefully now your experience is wider. And that wideness is allowing you to experience the other cars moving and the other drivers. And maybe that's giving rise to a sense of connectedness. You're all on the road together. Okay, Peter, how about if we continue with some kind of dialogue around embodied neuroscience?
The most recent developments in neuroscience are totally compatible with that experience. The experience working with the flight attendants, where we were refining down the Qigong to things that didn't even have to be practiced as separate from daily life, and finding that teaching that kind of non-practice, if you want to call it, teaching that kind of practice by video produced substantial, statistically significant, measurable changes in physiological as well as psychological health. So that was a big boost. It's like, wow, this is really doable and it really works. Most people who study Qigong end up with a string of exercises, you know, great exercises, but you have to take time aside from your daily life to practice those exercises. And if you don't practice them, then you consider yourself not to be practicing Qigong, just like with yoga or meditation. So it's really, for me, it was a huge step to realize, to have the actual evidence of how powerful this approach was, where you teach the essence of standing, walking, sitting, lying down, moving, breathing, although breathing is in a bit of a separate category, and interacting. The next thing that came up for us was my colleague Marty Crane was very, very interested in autism. And she herself had been trained in a system called Qigong sensory training that's very, very effective for autistic kids. I won't go into this in a lot of detail because I know you're going to be interviewing Marty later on and she'll probably talk a lot about that. We started to develop videos specifically for autistic kids to teach them some of these practices. We do have good reason to believe they can be very, very effective. So to do that, we developed a different kind of video that wasn't so much, you know, verbal didactic instruction, but instead used imagery and sound effects and video effects to convey the feeling of it. So for instance, we would have a video of a kid doing a basic Qigong exercise, a crane exercise, where you feel like a big bird in the sky, and then the background fades into seagulls flying in slow motion, and you hear the cry of the seagulls in the air, conveying the feeling of that. And that's something that we're currently involved actually in producing and in fundraising to be able to develop more of these videos and to be able to do clinical trials to really test how effective these are. We also really want to get into being able to make these available to many different populations. First responders, it would be fantastic because any of these practices show people how, one of the things is to show people how to center in the lower belly, which most people are not really aware of. It's a relatively simple thing to do, and it totally changes the way that your nervous system functions in relation to potentially traumatic situations.
So, Peter, you've slipped over into a territory that is very near and dear to me, one most psychologists, psychotherapists, and psychiatrists don't really know much about. That territory is the knowledge of the critical role the nervous system and microbes play in achieving and maintaining mental health.
One of the things that is extremely important for people to recognize is that Western science is so steeped in this concept of the mind and body being two separate realms. But it's very, very difficult for medicine and traditional Western psychotherapy, even if they never really think about the underlying philosophy. Nevertheless, the whole system is based on an underlying philosophy of knowledge, philosophy of science, which fundamentally divides mind and body. And even though there's a lot of lip service these days to, you know, mind, body, this and body, mind, that, it's actually very, very difficult to change the practice without addressing the underlying philosophy. This is one of the reasons why there seems to be so much resistance in the field of psychotherapy to including the body. Systems like somatic experiencing, which is a body-oriented form of trauma work, so you could call it a psychotherapy, but since psyche refers to the mind, psychotherapy literally means a therapy of the mind, so intrinsically excludes the body in its basic presumption. We don't really even have the vocabulary is somatic experiencing, does it work with the mind or does it work with the body? You know, and the answer is yes. Interestingly enough, you see the same kind of thing contemporary neuroscience. For a long time, neuroscience simply didn't really deal with actual direct conscious experience. It dealt on a level of, you know, the neurons and the reflexes and the structure of the brain and so forth. But in the last 20 years or so, there's been a huge resurgence or upsurge of interest in the neuroscience of the emotions, that's called affective neuroscience, the neuroscience of consciousness itself. And you have something called neurophenomenology, where phenomenology refers to direct conscious experience. And this was your friend and my, Evan Thompson, who has done a great deal of work with that, based on the seminal work of Francisco Varela. Neuroscience, which is based in science, which is based in a philosophy that separates mind and body and tries to keep the subjective out of it completely. But this science is now choosing to address conscious experience. So there's all sorts of controversies in neuroscience at the moment, in affective neuroscience, competing schools of thought. And a lot of that boils down to this question about how on earth do we address conscious experience within the context of a science that explicitly excludes conscious experience from consideration? Again, I'm saying even though people may not actually think about the philosophy, the underlying philosophy has a huge effect.
Affective neuroscience and cross-species studies have shown that primary process emotional feelings are organized within primitive subcortical regions of the brain. And these brain regions are anatomically, neurochemically, and functionally homologous in all mammals. That means all mammals, including us, we are animals. Now, emotional feelings, what we in psychology call affect, these emotional feelings are intrinsic mammalian qualities. And that's not something psychology thought 50 years ago. In fact, we now know that positive affects indicate in animals that they're returning to comfort zones. These comfort zones support their survival. And negative affects, which arise in animals, reflect discomfort zones. And these discomfort zones indicate that animals are in situations where they may have impaired survival. These are all called ancestral tools for living. And these tools are evolutionary memories encoded into DNA as primary brain processes. And these primary brain processes are then refined by basic learning and higher order thoughts. You know, we humans like to think of ourselves as having a lot of higher order thoughts, that we are not driven by basic learning or DNA encoded evolutionary habits and expectations. But it really isn't true. We are. And mutations rarely happen in genes, but epigenetic changes in gene expression is happening all the time. And that happens depending upon the circumstances we find ourselves in. You mentioned somatic experiencing therapy. This method allows patients to have direct contact and more intimacy with some of the body's processing mechanisms and partner with the human organism in its efforts to heal assaults to the nervous system that result from physical and emotional traumatic experiences. You know, trauma is not just in the mind and feelings. The body holds traumatic memories and reacts to them.
Yes, that's absolutely true. This is reflected in the way that talk therapy, which is much more conceptually oriented and is based on the idea that the cortex controls everything, it's what they call top-down influence, that does not really have great degrees of success working with trauma. The theory of somatic experiencing, as you know, is that trauma is a matter of the nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, and the subcortical centers that you were just talking about, and that it's difficult to address that via thoughts and concepts coming down from above. I find this shift extremely exciting and absolutely necessary, and the issue of addressing trauma has become a kind of catalyst for that, because everybody recognizes how extremely important it is to address trauma and how widespread it is. The necessity of addressing it, I believe, is really pushing psychotherapy in the direction of accepting working with the body.
The work you and Marty are doing with COPD sufferers is so powerful. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is a very distressful illness. And what you are offering is a bottom-up intervention that works systemically rather than a symptom-targeted therapy. I imagine the Qigong offers the flight attendants a sense of relief, maybe even greater ease in a daily existence that must be quite arduous.
That's exactly right. And COPD itself triggers a kind of vicious circle, because you get you get scared because you can't breathe properly, and the fear creates further contraction, which makes breathing even harder. So it's very difficult to say in most COPD patients how much is really a purely physiological change of the tissue and how much is an alteration of the overall functioning of the nervous system. So for me, the framework of saying we can teach you how to regulate and balance the functioning of your nervous system. And by nervous system there, we mean the brain and all the peripheral nervous system too. Brain is called the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord, the peripheral nervous system too. So, you know, it's really a way of saying your whole being, your whole self, and that you can learn ways to create a better functioning whole. We're not really addressing symptoms per se. We're addressing the functioning of the whole system, if you like, all the capacities of the system to heal itself and to recover.
So, Peter, it sounds like for you, the Qigong intervention is a way to help COPD sufferers work on systemic functioning rather than work piecemeal on specific aspects of the disease process. I am curious if the feedback you receive from study participants is reflective of a systemic shift. Have they directly mentioned feeling an innate embodied well-being arising in the body, mind, and heart as a result of the Qigong? And is it palpable in their daily lives?
I mean, we have the specific biomarkers that we measure to see the objective changes of health. But then we also invited a kind of free-form response, you know, how did you find the practice? And we even asked people 6 months to a year after the end of the study, how much are you still doing and what kind of benefits do you observe? And a very large number of people were still doing it, were still actively using it, and expressed kind of great gratitude for having been introduced to the practice. And they would say things like, you know, I enjoy my life more. I feel so much more present to everything. I handle stress much more easily. A whole bunch of different things, definitely indicating that kind of systemic change.
Did you find that the amount of practice participants actually did led to a certain result?
Yes, we actually did. That was a very important question. Again, about a year after the practice, we sent out a questionnaire asking them to, first of all, tell us how much practice they were doing, you know, how frequently they were doing, which exercises and so forth. And then also asking about their health, asking about 7 or 8 different facets of physical health and 4 or 5 different facets of mental health. And what we found, to our delight, was that those two measures correlated quite significantly. Now, this is over the course of a year with all sorts of different things, you know, could happen up and down. But we got an R-value correlation of 0.6, which indicates roughly a third of the change in their health was due to the practices.
Earlier, we talked about the Qigong videos you created and then used in the studies. But then you also mentioned that many of the participants were realizing the Qigong practices in the midst of their daily lives, doing standing posture practice while waiting on a line. I'm curious if you collected measures or if you got a good sense from participant feedback how much people were using the Qigong videos for practice as opposed to just practicing in their daily activities, like walking or standing or sitting?
Yeah, it was pretty clear that they watched the videos to learn the practices initially and to refresh them. But mostly what they were doing was using it in the midst of daily life. There was some variation in the sense that some people would say, you know, oh, I do the shakeout every day, which is a small practice that you can't really do in the midst of daily life. You have to actually, you know, stand there and shake your arms and legs and stuff. But the majority of people were talking absolutely about, I keep this with me all the time. I remember when I'm walking down the street. It was the integration with daily life that did it.
So the people who were actually practicing more in their daily life were experiencing a higher level of benefit or result.
It was very clear. Yes.
Very clear.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're familiar with the concept that they call the hard problem of consciousness.
For those of you who don't know, the hard problem of consciousness is a term coined by philosopher Dave Chalmers. It refers to the difficulty of explaining how and why we have phenomenal experience, how sensations acquire characteristics such as colors and tastes. These characteristics are known as qualia. Dave Chalmers contrasted this hard problem of consciousness with what he called the easy problems of consciousness. For instance, explaining how human brains discriminate, integrate information, report mental states, and focus attention. We humans don't seem to have much trouble figuring out brain processes, but we do have trouble figuring out why we are conscious.
I'm so interested in this problem, and every time I come across an article or a book that says, you know, okay, here's how we resolve it, I read it and then I go, nope, sorry, you have not actually resolved that. There's controversy around that. Some people actually still in this age will say, no, there's no proof that animals are conscious and that human emotion is produced by entirely different functions than the animal emotion and so forth. There's still controversy about it. The essence of that controversy is the hard problem of consciousness. We don't understand the relationship of conscious experience to matter, you know, to the brain in particular. One person who has been really of seminal influence in this whole thing is Francisco Varela.
Yes.
And his work has been carried on by his colleague, Evan Thompson. And Varela was incredibly prolific in terms of the various different kinds of theories that he initiated. He was way ahead of his time, an extraordinary person. He felt that some of the theories that he was developing would explain the hard problem of consciousness. In order to really understand this, you had to go through a personal process of training and self-development to transform your own conscious awareness, your own capacity to be aware, in such a way that you could understand this. That is a radical concept, because it's really saying, no matter what the scientist does in their lab, no matter what they invent, unless they transform their own consciousness through a form of personal practice, they won't be able to fully resolve this gap. And so they won't be able to formulate fully coherent theories of the neuroscience of phenomenological experience.
So I am contemplating the radical upset many neuroscience researchers may be experiencing right now hearing you say this.
You know, we talk about consciousness from a certain point of view. Everybody knows what consciousness is. It seems very clear and straightforward.
They know they're conscious. They have the actual experience, but they have no idea how it happens or what it is.
Neuroscientists and philosophers spend a lot of time thinking about consciousness. Now, in the highest realms of Buddhism, I'm talking particularly about Dzogchen, which is a particular aspect of Buddhism, there's this idea of recognizing the nature of mind. Most Buddhists, they can train their entire lives and never get to a recognition of the nature of mind. Well, if it's so hard for a Buddhist who specializes in this, how can a neuroscientist or a psychologist say, yeah, I understand what consciousness is? So to me, there is a huge gap here that you're trying to formulate a science about something that you have never actually investigated directly.
I'd like to offer a middle way perspective on all this, because the Buddha and 2,600 years of subsequent Buddhist teachers did not have the benefit of modern neuroscience. Sometimes I wonder if they had had access to this knowledge that we have about how the brain functions and how perception works, that they might have come up with other conclusions, or maybe even other frameworks to explain consciousness. What one knows can change so much about how one interprets what one perceives. But of course, it's really hard to say. What I do know is that Francesco Varela was so important in this whole endeavor. He embodied both streams of inquiry with such intelligence and fearlessness. He was a Buddhist practitioner and engaged seriously in first-person meditative contemplation. He was also a pioneering, visionary neuroscience researcher. Of course, it may take a lot more time for these two streams of knowledge to find their way toward concordance or even parallelism, or even, in the best of all worlds, an interdependence upon one another.
Varela's work, Varela's and Thompson's work, has been picked up and continued by a number of different people. And there's one person in particular I'm thinking of called Scott Jordan. The shift or the accomplishment or whatever that we're talking about is really edging over the horizon right now. But it does depend upon making the connection between the theoretical conceptual knowledge of neuroscience and the actual direct experience that we have. And that includes the scientists and everybody.
The work you and Marty are doing is so pivotal. You are delivering Qigong and other embodied practices that actually work, and then using biological measures to test their effectiveness. Not a lot of labs are doing that. Is there any information you want to make sure listeners have about you or your research? Certainly how they can find you guys online.
Well, first of all, let me say thank you very much for what you just said. It's definitely, it's been my life work. It feels like this is what I'm on the planet to do, and I'm really enjoying doing it. So I would like to steer people towards our website. So myself and Marty have set up a company called Body Mind Science to fundraise and promote the research around these things. And our website is bodymindscience.info. It's only recently up. There's a fair amount of information there. There will be a whole lot more. There are some sample videos that you can see. And there's also links to all our papers, ways of getting in contact with us and so forth. And we really, we welcome so much anybody who's interested in communicating with us about any of this in any way.
Thank you so much, Peter, for being here and offering so much incredible information today.
Oh, it was absolutely my pleasure, Lisa, and I really appreciate this opportunity. So great to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. The Groundless Ground podcast is now available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. To find out more about this episode, see a list of upcoming guests, or get in touch, visit groundlessground.com. Now let's dedicate our efforts to the healing of our planet and all its inhabitants. See you next time on the Groundless Ground.